Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Okay, technically we have more than just two political parties. There's the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, and the Constitution Party, as well as a whole host of other small organizations. But as Charlie Gibson pointed out during the primary debate in New Hampshire, Ron Paul left the Libertarian Party for the Republicans when he decided to make a serious run for president.
Congressman Paul, respect to you. I don't know that you've changed much except your party, because you were a Libertarian when you first ran for president.
So what's the future for the fledgling Tea Party? I don't know, but I'm sure Ron Paul has some insights that maybe I don't. So we'll ask him on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 5th, and the takeaway for me is if anybody would know about how to function within either a major party or a so-called third party, it would be Ron Paul, for sure. We're going to talk to him. He's the Republican representative for the 14th Congressional District of Texas, founder of the advocacy group Campaign for Liberty in just a few minutes.
Memo to self. He might want to talk about the gold standard as well. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. For Toyota's president, it was time to face the music this morning. He apologized for quality problems within the hour that led to the recall of more than 9 million cars in recent months.
Please believe me, we always customer first is first priority.
Akio Toyoda said the company would soon announce what steps it would take to address brake problems in its 2010 Prius model, but did not announce another recall. Speaking to The World today, the managing director of Toyota in the UK, Miguel Fonseca, said there was no reason for the public to lose confidence in Toyota products.
If nobody has experienced any harsh throttle, it will not going to happen between now and the recall.
Toyota also says it's investigating possible brake problems with its Lexus hybrid. The company says it hasn't received any complaints about it, but it's looking into it because the Lexus uses the same basic brake system as the Prius.
And the Prius problems don't end with the brakes. The Los Angeles Times is reporting there have been over 1,000 complaints about the headlights shutting off without warning. Other Prius owners have complained of their cars shutting off completely, sometimes while in motion. For the latest, we're joined now by Jerome Vaughn, news director for our member station WDET in Detroit. Good morning, Jerome.
Good morning.
So we heard some apologies from the president of Toyota. Did we hear any details and possibly some comments into the investigation into the electronics system in the Toyota cars?
Not a lot of details. Mostly apologies, reassurance that safety was Toyota's top concern right now, but they haven't officially said whether they're going to have a recall or not of the Prius.
But, you know, a lot of these parts that go into making cars are the same as in many cars all along their platform. So are we expecting to hear about more investigations and more problems?
Yes, Toyota is in the spotlight right now, so a lot more is expected to come to the surface as investigations continue. And Toyota will likely be announcing some more things on its own in the days ahead.
Well, Jerome Vaughn, news director for member station WDET in Detroit, thanks so much.
Another big story out of Afghanistan. The NATO offensive, long-awaited, has begun into Helmand province. British troops began clearing the area around the city of Marja in preparation for a NATO assault on the city, which will include troops from the Obama surge to that country.
In Haiti, the 10 Americans who tried to take children out of the country last week without permission have been charged with kidnapping. They face prison terms of up to 15 years and are not eligible for bail. And here at home, the latest unemployment numbers will be announced later this morning. Expectations are for a small net increase in jobs, but the jobless rate could creep up to 10.1%. In the markets, futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,002. The S&P starts at 1,063 and the NASDAQ at 2,125. Later this hour, we're going to be talking to soul legend Bill Withers about the new documentary film about his life called Still Bill.
Coming up, the Tea Party convention moves into day two in honor of our special guest Ron Paul coming, who joins us. We're asking our listeners to tell us the platforms of their new political party. Here's what you do. You call 877-8-MY-TAKE, name your party, tell us the platform, or you can post it to our website, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Ron Paul is in the Republican Party, though. Coming up.
What began as the frustration of a group of libertarians over the election of Barack Obama and then continued as loud protests during debates over health care legislation is now coalescing in the Tea Party Nation convention in Nashville, which began yesterday. The Tea Party members are trying to figure out how to carry the momentum of their anger with this administration and with the government in general into an actual movement or perhaps a new political party. But during the 2008 presidential campaign, frustrated libertarians flocked to a different revolution. That was the Ron Paul Revolution in support of the Texas congressman's small government platform. And we are joined by Congressman Ron Paul now. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So I'm wondering how you feel about this Tea Party campaign. Is it as an extension as the supporters of your presidential campaign?
Oh, I think it is an extension in many ways because there's a lot of people who are very unhappy with the current events in government and what's happening. But that doesn't mean that everybody goes to every one of these Tea Party groups endorses what I've been doing. But I think it just taps into how many people are unhappy. And I think you have to look at each group and figure out what they're really talking about.
You know, that you talk about going to each group, that's kind of the essential issue here, because I don't think they are coalescing under any one particular person or any one particular platform. They've touched into a strong passion and a frustration with government. But there seems to be a lot of different priorities among the many disparate groups of the Tea Party.
But the one thing is they're unhappy with Washington. Not only unhappy, they're angry. And they know there's something seriously wrong. And I think it's a very healthy movement because they're recognizing there is a problem. They're not apathetic, and they're directing their attention in the right way, and it's toward Washington, D.C., because our government there is too big. It's totally out of control. The deficits are exploding. We're doing too much around the world. It's a failed state. But our responsibility, those of us who are involved, should try to sort this out and tell them what the solutions are, and that's what I concentrate on a lot, and certainly in the campaign I did. And the meetings I go to are generally college-oriented, the young people, but I'm very precise on what we should offer as an alternative rather than just the anger.
You know, we saw a lot of this anger and frustration during the Bush administration as well. That kind of coalesced under the auspices of the Democratic Party and was probably a big part of what helped to get Barack Obama into office. And we spoke with a member of the Tea Party yesterday who was actually frustrated over the attempts of the Republican Party to kind of swallow up their movement also and make this part of the Republican Party. Do you think that the Tea Party is destined to either become part of one of the major parties or just kind of dissipate?
And that's a mixed blessing. That shows the Tea Party movement's very strong, but it also gives you a real challenge. Will they come into the Tea Party movement and dilute it and go back to typical Republican politics, or will they be influenced by what the Tea Party people demand? The real frustration comes from the fact that we don't have true democracy here. If you're not a Republican or Democrat, you can't get very far. How many congressmen are independent or third-party members? It's just difficult because it's hard to get on the ballots, hard to get in the debates, hard to get the coverage, hard to raise money. It always bothers me that we go overseas and fight and kill, and we're going to spread democracy. And we have a lot of shortcomings here, so movements like this can't go into a party. But I also believe if there's a true revolution, a change in ideas, that it will pervade in both parties.
But
if there's a change in attitude about economic system and what we should do with foreign policy, we will eventually influence both parties.
But Congressman, that's just my worry here. I mean, everyone is waiting for the independents to coalesce under some political program, but you're talking about something that we've heard really, since before Ronald Reagan, running against Washington, calling for smaller government. It's the same sort of message. Bill Clinton had this message. The Bushes had this message. Run against Washington. Then you get into Washington, and all of a sudden you're co-opted by Washington, and we have the situation that we're dealing with now.
Yeah, but there's a difference this time because there's greater anger in the movement is outside the party structure.
So was Ross Perot.
Yeah, and that was a start, and there was no follow-through, but his philosophy wasn't as precise. He was only able to do it because he was wealthy. I mean, he tapped into it, but there was no follow-through. Once he was gone, it was over. But I think right now, this is not going to go away because government has failed. They're not going to get out of this mess soon. The deficits aren't going to go away. They're going to get worse. The monetary system is going to get worse. The dollar is going to have bigger trouble. We're going to have inflation. The foreign policy is deeply flawed. And people know that we don't get any change regardless of the party.
I think there is a hunger and an appetite out there for a departure from the two-party system. But, you know, what I'm seeing with the Tea Party is a party that most likely may get swallowed up by the Republicans. I mean, the people speaking at the convention are for the most part Republican politicians or Republican activists. There's a lot of Tea Party people boycotting the convention because they don't get along with the other people in the Tea Party. They don't agree on what's important.
It's pretty messy business, there's no doubt about it, but when you look at the big picture, there's still some benefits from this. And I think that's the reason that my efforts have been directed toward, trying to get a certain crowd out. I'm not looking for what you're talking about because that gets a little mixed up. But I'm talking to young people who accept the idea that personal liberty is important, that a foreign policy change is necessary, that the Federal Reserve is important, that deficits are horrible. And if you go to some of these Tea Party movements, you know, it's all mixed up. I mean, they might want to expand the war overseas, and we can't solve our problems if we don't change our foreign policy. Bush was elected because he was complaining about Clinton doing too much overseas. He didn't like nation building. Obama, you know, was elected because he was a peace candidate to stop the war, and he's expanding the war. The people I talk to are sick of this, including many people in the military. I have a lot of support for the military. So this is my emphasis. So, yes, I certainly don't have, control on what all the Tea Party people are thinking, but I compete with the Republican Party that wants to go in and make them adapt to the typical Republican message. But they have to regain, credibility because they had their chance. And like you said earlier, that everybody runs against Washington and nobody does anything about it. And that's why we have this Tea Party movement. Yeah. So
it's real to see if it actually results in third-party politics. Right, Ron Paul is a Republican representative for the 14th Congressional District of Texas. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
Toyota leads the news in his first press conference since the global recalls began. Toyota President Akio Toyoda apologized to customers and said he's doing his best to get vehicles fixed.
I'm trying to do this work as soon as possible and with cooperation of our employee and our supplier and the dealers.
The CEO said the company is considering a recall on 270,000 Prius hybrid cars over brake problems, and the automaker is taking a closer look at the Lexus hybrid to see if it has the same problem. Toyota's not the only automaker having these kinds of problems. Ford says they plan to fix almost 18,000 of their hybrids because of a software problem that also involves brakes, and that decision involves the Mercury Milan and the Ford Fusion.
At a fundraiser last night, President Obama said it's unbelievable that any American would be opposed to reforming a health care system that puts insurance companies' needs over the needs of sick patients.
Everybody's been harmed by what's happened. And every voter out there, Democrat, Republican, Independent, is furious about what happened. So my hope would be that Washington would respond.
President says his first priority is a jobs bill, but he plans to move on to a health care vote soon after. Overseas, an American missionary who illegally crossed into North Korea from China is going to be released. North Korea says the American who was detained at Christmas is repentant. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up,
when we come out of high school and stuff like that, we're supposed to be going out there and being on our own, but we probably know what we want to do in life, but we don't know how to go out there and get it.
Inner city youngsters and their challenge when it comes to finding a job.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some news takeouts, and there seems to be a lot of frustration from the Obama administration, at least, over the political gridlock going in Washington. This is something that Vice President Joe Biden talked about yesterday after new Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown was sworn in. Here's what Joe Biden had to say.
It is a useful tool. It's legitimate. But I, from my perspective, it has been, having served here, having been elected to the Senate 7 times, I've never seen a time when it's become sort of standard operating procedure. You want to get anything done, you have to have a supermajority. And I really mean this, unrelated to whether or not Barack and I are sitting down in the West Wing now. Any president in the future having to move through anything he or she wants, requiring a supermajority, is just, it's not a good way to do business. So hopefully, I don't have the answer. You're about to ask me the, I don't know what the answer is.
We're joined now by Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, you were there when Joe Biden was making those remarks yesterday. He clearly sounds very frustrated. Was he as frustrated by the supermajority when he was a senator?
Well, when Joe Biden was a senator for, what did he say? He was elected 7 times to the Senate. He didn't serve that 7th one because he became VP. But he used the filibuster just like most senators do. He was never leader. But Biden is frustrated, like all Democrats are frustrated right now by the filibuster. But he stopped short of what some Democrats are calling for. And we've covered it on this show, changing the filibuster rule or making it 55 or 52. He didn't say that because that would be sort of another nuclear option. But he is sensing the frustration from the White House. He says the president is frustrated as well. And what he's hoping for is some relief from what he calls this spasm of partisanship.
We'll see if there's any movement in the future. Thanks so much, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
An unusual economic takeout now as we wait for the unemployment number later this morning. You know, it's probably hard to feel the sting of a recession if, say, you're an investment banker, right? And you're getting only a $2 million bonus. Okay, maybe the number's down, but you're not really feeling any change, any actual sacrifice. But at the other end of the economic spectrum, the recession is also abstract to people in communities who never saw much of a boom the past 2 decades at all. So Ibrahim Abdelmateen, normally our sports contributor, he sort of lives an economic double life, we learn. He joins us early in the morning, hears all those economic statistics that lead our newscasts, but then by day, he's a community and youth leader in East New York, a neighborhood that prosperity has passed by for generations, and that most New Yorkers never venture out to, since it's on the outskirts of Brooklyn and only connected by 2 major train lines. The faces of the people in this neighborhood you can't see in the statistics, and their faces Ibrahim Abdelmateen sees every day. We wanted to meet some of these people. Ibrahim, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk about East New York. What does it look like? And, you know, it's not a boom or bust economy. It's been bust pretty much for as long as you've ever been associated with it.
It's a very industrial neighborhood.
Right.
When you look out into the landscape, you look and it's a very bleak area. But I think Ramasu Ryan, who's one of the young people that I work with, he can describe it the best way.
I live in East New York. I live in Brooklyn. There's a lot of broken down houses. There's a lot of broken down lots. There's a lot of drug houses, crack spots. And like, you don't even have to walk that far from the train station in order to see a group of gangsters on the corner slinging drugs.
So how old is Ramasu? He's a job trainee.
Ramasu, I believe he's 20. He's a new dad. He's trying to make a decision. Should he join the training program and get ready, get the skills to get out into the workforce, or should he go into the military, which is something that he had wanted to do for a while, but then the urgency of it came even more so when he realized that he was going to be a new dad.
So, you know, there's an uphill battle trying to get work if you're from East New York, because the unemployment rate, I think, dwarfs the 10% unemployment that's in the United States.
That's correct. Actually, according to the Fiscal Policy Institute, it's 1 in 5 people in East New York are unemployed, which is the highest unemployment rate in the 5 boroughs in New York City.
So you're facing that statistic, which sort of says, all right, it's economically bleak in this neighborhood. What other messages do young people get in East New York which might suggest to them, hey, forget about boom or bust. You guys aren't going anywhere.
Oftentimes, I see young people that they're very sensitive. So you criticize them, and they want to snap at you. You know, you joke with them, and then they're like, I don't know anything. So they're very sensitive. It goes back to some of their experiences when they were younger. We spoke with Ian Hardy, and Ian's 19 years old, yeah. And well, he's been badgered by negative messages ever since he was in 8th grade.
I was in 8th grade in my classroom, my social studies class, and my teacher, she said, I will never amount to nothing, so, like, don't bother coming to school. Or taking any like tests and stuff like that.
Well, we talk on this program a lot about discouraged workers, people who don't look for work anymore, who don't show up in the statistics, and we're solidly in this population at this point. And I imagine it takes a certain wisdom to negotiate how to pull people out of this kind of a economically distressed community. What do they think of you?
Well, that's funny. We were talking the other day about how do I connect with them? You know, my experience wasn't necessarily their experience, but I don't think you need to have a similar experience to connect with young people that come from difficult backgrounds. There's a saying, young people from the urban areas and young people from the suburbs, they all have the same levels of intelligence, same level of understanding, same level of work ethic. But the difference is the kids from the suburbs believe that their analysis is going to change the world and change their life. The people in the urban areas, they think that their analysis is irrelevant and it's not going to change their life.
But occasionally you meet somebody who definitely has an attitude that sort of stands out. Listen to this.
People say it's not jobs out here, but it is. You just have to, you know, you have to look. And like when you get turned down, I think people take it as a negative thing. Like if it just turned into a positive thing, is like they don't hire you. Well, you could say like they missed out on like a good worker or something. You know, like if you motivate yourself, you won't be put down.
It took her 2 extra years to graduate from high school. That's Carrie L. I love the hope and the honesty that comes from these young people. And that's the biggest thing, is that with all these difficult pressures, they're still able to find this fissure of hope that will carry them through.
And you tell them every day that there are opportunities out there in the green economy, even in a place like East New York. Do you believe that?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I mean, with all the weatherization work that needs to happen, with all the innovation that needs to come, some of the innovation is going to come from these young people.
You know, listening to the voices rather than looking at the numbers. And the solution there is going to come from our own Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor on the streets of New York every day. And Ibrahim is on his way to work at this hour. You can hear more from the young people Ibrahim works with in East New York in a special audio slideshow at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, read Ibrahim's blog post about the decade he spent working with young people. And while we await the unemployment number, which is out in the next few minutes, there's yet another case filed against the Toyota Motor Company. We're going to talk about that in just a minute.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. The Labor Department is just releasing the unemployment number. We'll have it for you in just a few moments. And coming up, we're going to talk about Toyota Motor Company, its apology today, and also more cases that might have disturbing recall implications. Right now, let's check on the top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. The latest unemployment numbers are just out. We expect a slight increase, but the January unemployment rate actually dropped. It now is reportedly at 9.7% from a 10% decline, or a 10% rate, which it stood at the month before. That's going to move the market. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit later.
In an effort to create more jobs, President Obama will ask Congress to temporarily expand 2 lending programs for the owners of small businesses. But to be eligible for them, business owners must have first mortgages and be current on all loan payments for the previous year. The president will announce the plan later this morning in Maryland. One of the largest offenses in the Afghan war has begun this morning. British attack helicopters are now clearing the outskirts of the city of Marja in preparation for NATO troops to come in. General Stanley McChrystal, top commander in Afghanistan, U.S. commander, was asked why he announced the Helmand offensive in advance.
We're trying to signal to the Afghan people that we are expanding security where they live. We are trying also to signal to the insurgents, the Taliban, primarily in this area, and the narco-traffickers, that it's about to change.
The assault on Marja itself will be the first operation to employ some of the 30,000 new troops that are part of the surge. And in Haiti, the 10 Americans who tried to take children out of the country last week without permission have been charged with child kidnapping and criminal conspiracy. Last night on Larry King Live, the Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive said the charges are appropriate.
It's clear that those people violated the law. What we have to understand, if they do it in a good faith, or if they were linked to other traffic.
The Americans face prison terms of up to 15 years. They are not eligible for bail. Here at home, the New York Attorney General Office filed civil charges against Bank of America and its former CEO, Ken Lewis, yesterday. Checking on the markets, Asian and European markets are down. The futures are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,002. The S&P starts at 1,063 and the NASDAQ at 2,125. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So as we reported, Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, apologized to customers this morning in his first news conference since all those massive global recalls began last month. Toyota's president also admitted the 2010 Prius has brake problems and that they were still considering a recall of those Prius hybrids. The flaw could affect other models as well. But just a short week ago, Toyota seemed to have a huge reservoir of trust that sounded like this.
So far, I have had no problems with my cars, and I'm sure if there a problem comes up, they can fix it. I have implicit trust in, ample trust in Toyota.
I've always liked Toyota. They're so dependable, and I've talked to people, too. They will stick with Toyota
because their previous owners, and they still will trust Toyota.
But despite the recalls, the company is certainly betting that its customers will stand fast, both because of the way cars are designed these days and because of Toyota's reluctance to respond to reports of problems. There are, in any case, increasing calls for looks at the entire industry now.
We'd like to see the government and the auto industry set up a task force to take a fresh look at all the issues associated with the electronics and the electrical systems in modern automobiles.
It's Clarence Zitlow in an interview with the Associated Press yesterday. He's the executive director for the Center for Auto Safety in Washington. So is this about electronics and electrical systems in all cars, or just Toyota's corporate style of management? A new case involving the crash and death of a former auto worker driving her 2005 Toyota Camry, though, may raise some new issues across the Toyota product line. We're joined by New York Times Detroit Bureau Chief William Vlasic, who writes about this in today's paper. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So let's talk, first of all, about this specific case and then raise this sort of broader issue of whether the electronic design of cars at Toyota and other makers actually causes investigators to look at the entire product line of these companies. First of all, what happened to this woman?
Well, this fatal accident in Flint, Michigan in 2008, 2005 model Toyota Camry driven by a woman by the name of Guadalupe Alberto. Very, a very violent crash, one car crash, car speeding wildly out of control, in the middle of a Saturday afternoon. And, no floor mats in this car, and this car was also not among those that were recalled for sticky accelerator pedals. Therefore, it really can't be explained by the actions Toyota has already taken.
And let's just pause there for a second. There was some discussion by the company that the mechanical problem that motivated this recall of 4 million vehicles had something to do with the floor mats, but if they weren't in the car, this obviously isn't the case here.
No, they have to eliminate floor mats and problems with a sticky pedal because, again, this car was not in their recall group. The lawsuit is alleging that this was a problem with Toyota's electronic throttle control system, which is a very sophisticated computerized device that controls the speed of the engine on many, many, many Toyota cars. Toyota has steadfastly said there is nothing wrong. They cannot find any problems with their electronic systems, but clearly the government is looking very closely at this, and Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood the other day said that electronics are sort of the next stage of this inquiry.
You know, he's been on our program talking just broadly about the electronic sort of proliferation within the cockpit and within cars is a real problem for him and raises a lot of issues for him. You heard Clarence Zitlow of the Center for Auto Safety in Washington there talking about the government needs to take a fresh look at cars. Do you think these electronic designs possibly motivate a completely different view of safety than we've had up till now?
They're extremely complex and proprietary in many cases to each different car maker.
Uh-huh.
And as we've found in looking through investigations by the government previously into Toyotas, it appears that the National Highway Traffic Safety Agency may not have all the technical capabilities themselves to analyze this equipment. So
let's unpack that for a second, William Vlasic. So if it's proprietary, that means the company actually keeps it a secret. So investigators trying to figure out the safety concerns of a particular design actually don't even have access to the design files.
Well, what they have access to are complaints of incidents, and automakers, you know, are required to turn over any data that they have on any accidents or complaints from consumers. In this particular case, Camrys have been investigated for this electronic issues, but sometimes they don't get all the reports because there's so many of them. Sometimes they segregate them. It's just a very complicated new area that is going to require a different kind of technical expertise than looking at traditional mechanical issues in a car.
Right. Well, on the one hand, you're talking about design and electronics that have moved beyond the capacity of regulators to actually oversee. But what do you think this particular case is going to mean for Toyota the next few days or weeks?
Well, this case is drawing comparisons to the very awful crash out in San Diego last summer that killed four people, including a highway patrolman, where you just have a very, very high-speed, essentially one car accident with an experienced driver and a car with no problems previously. Unfortunately, sometimes these horrible accidents are what get the draw the attention to a specific problem. And, you know, these may be rare occurrences, but they're catastrophic. And so I'm expecting that this case, along with a few others that were really violent crashes, will probably heighten the interest of regulators and maybe lawmakers as well to look at the electronics.
And maybe we'll get beyond simply apologies like we had today. William Vlasic, thanks so much. William Vlasic is the Detroit bureau chief for our partner, the New York Times, speaking about Toyota and a new fatality case that's written about in the New York Times today. The Tea Party Convention is moving into day two in honor of our special guest, Ron Paul, who was with us earlier in this hour. We're asking our listeners to name a political party and give us your platform. What would your party fight for? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. So a lot of big news came down the line yesterday regarding allegations of fraud at Bank of America. Here's the first one. The Securities and Exchange Commission announced a new settlement with B of A, and the attorney general in the company's home state of North Carolina also announced a new settlement. But New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo filed new charges of fraud against both the bank, Bank of America, and two of its former chief executives. Here with details now, we have Louise Story, finance and business reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, there was a lot of news coming out about B of A. Maybe you can give us the rundown and help us understand what happened.
Good morning. Yes, it was kind of like all these different agencies were just racing each other to make announcements. You know, we're sitting there, and first, Attorney General Andrew Cuomo from New York, who's been investigating for the bank, said he had filed charges. You know, you've heard a lot about his investigation because there have been leaks of some of the different testimony he's taken, but these were the first charges. And he's filing the charges under the Martin Act, which gives the Attorney General of New York very big powers over securities investigations. And what he's accusing the bank of is not disclosing the losses at Merrill Lynch, which Bank of America bought at the height of the financial crisis before that deal closed. Merrill Lynch just fell apart. It was bleeding money, and Bank of America kept that a secret from their shareholders even when they voted on the deal. So he did that. At the same time, you're right, the SEC, which had a major case running against the bank, settled it. And if you recall from last August, the SEC already settled something with the bank, and a judge threw that out. Do you remember this? I mean,
right,
it was
right,
like, this never happened. The SEC and the bank were going to just kind of wipe their hands this thing really fast, and a judge threw the settlement out. So this is a much larger settlement, but it'll have to go back to that
same
judge.
The judge said, you can't do this. You can't just make this quick settlement.
That's right.
These issues are
the
too large.
The judge was very critical. His name is Jed Rakoff. He's in New York. He's very well known for kind of taking maverick views, and he said this fine, it was $33 million. It's too small. So this time around, the fine is $150 million. And he said, why aren't you pointing the finger at executives? This time around, the SEC has not done that. So that may still bother him. And they'll go before the judge on Monday, and he may or may not approve this one.
And that's what a lot of people are saying, that is because there's no indictments of CEOs or executives from the bank, he may throw out this settlement as well.
It's hard to know. But when you look at Attorney General Cuomo's case, there are very clearly our fingers pointed in particular at Ken Lewis, who was the CEO of Bank of America till he retired at the beginning of this year, and at Joe Price. And I will tell you, when you read this 90-page complaint, it's pretty damning in particular for Joe Price. There's a lot more in there about him. It says that he did not tell Bank of America's own lawyers how bad the losses were. So when the lawyers were giving him advice on whether to disclose the lawyers, he was obscuring from them, according to the complaint, how bad it was. And in fact, there's a scene in there where Joe Price, the former CFO, is sitting there with his deputies, and one of his deputies says to him, Joe, I don't want to be talking to you through a sheet of glass. You know, meaning like right. In jail.
Yeah, okay. Wow. Louise Story, we're definitely going to have to be following how this goes and whether this results in a real trial against these executives. Louise Story, business and finance reporter for the New York Times. Coming up, we'll be talking to soul legend Bill Withers. We're also asking you today, I wonder if there's people in your life that you feel like you're too polarized to even have a conversation with them. Not necessarily just on politics, but maybe even on food. How do you get over these polarized opinions? 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at the takeaway.org.
I can't talk to you anymore, Celeste. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And are you on your way to happy?
You know, it's okay to head out for wonderful, but on your way to wonderful, you're going to have to pass through all right.
You're going to make it to happy because soul legend Bill Withers is talking to us in just a minute about his road to wonderful. That interview just coming right up. But first, a check of leading stories. It's coming up on 48 minutes after the hour. Economic news came out in the last few minutes. The January unemployment rate took an unexpected turn downward, 9.7% from 10% the month before. Newsweek columnist Dan Gross joins us with the details. And the details really do matter in this month's report, right, Dan?
Yeah, there's a bit of everything in here. So the unemployment rate fell from 10% to 9.7%. That is good news. The payroll numbers, that's the number of people on companies' payrolls, that number of fell 20,000, so we did not yet have job gains, although when you have a data set of 130 million, you know, the difference between a loss of 20,000 and a gain of 20,000 is a
right.
tiny error. Nonetheless, a lost November, which we originally thought we gained 10,000 jobs, that was revised to a bigger gain, so more jobs were created in November than we thought.
That's positive.
But December was down, revised to a loss of about 150,000 jobs.
So it really does look like we're bouncing along the bottom here. There were 11,000 new factory jobs in January. What's that all about?
Well, look, manufacturing, you know, was cut very sharply in the wake of the financial crisis, and we have been building off that lower base. Exports have been bouncing back, and so, you know, we talked earlier, I think about an hour ago, about these insane productivity numbers. Companies are adding people. Car companies, you know, production in this quarter is much larger than it was
right.
a year ago. So there are kind of incremental gains in manufacturing.
All right. Newsweek columnist Dan Gross talking about the unemployment number. It stands at 9.7% from 10%. Some unexpectedly positive news. Toyota's president has apologized for the company's massive recalls from Tokyo. He promised to produce quality control by setting up a special committee he will head himself.
The Federal Reserve is buying $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities. It's an effort to prop up the economy, but they plan to stop the purchases on the final day of March. Overseas now, an American missionary, Robert Park, who crossed into North Korea from China, is going to be released. North Korea says the American, who was detained at Christmas, is repentant. In Iraq, at least 27 people have been killed by bombs, apparently aimed at Shia pilgrims in the Iraqi city of Kerbala. And in Haiti, 10 American missionaries who've been charged with kidnapping children in the country are facing up to 3 months in detention as they wait for trial. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Lean on me when you're not strong.
We got a movie music segment this morning. You have a musical background, right, Celeste?
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
That is a song that you listen to it and you go, how could somebody write a song like that? Just sounds
Where does that come from?
Where does that come from? And, of course, Lean on Me is the Bill Withers tune. And as a very special guest for this segment, we have soul legend Bill Withers, who's famous not only for that song, but also Just the Two of Us.
Yeah.
Ain't No Sunshine.
Ain't No Sunshine, yep. Absolutely.
And Lovely
Grandma's
Day.
Hands.
The movie connection here is Still Bill. It's a new film that documents Bill Withers' career and life from his early days, being raised by his grandmother back in West Virginia, to his Grammy Award wins, his choice to step back from the music industry when he was at his peak. Good morning, Mr. Bill Withers.
How are you?
How do you write a song like Lean On Me?
Well, you're kind of walking around scratching yourself and something crosses your mind, you know? I don't know.
Man, that says it all.
I have no idea how that process works.
Well, Bill Withers, let's talk about your early life and your grandma and the song Grandma's Hands.
Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hands played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hands.
So Celeste referred to that song just a moment ago. I can see your grandma in that song.
Yeah.
Tell me about your grandmother and how much influence she had on you.
Well, I don't think it was just my grandmother. People as diverse as Johnny Cash and Barbara Streisand and people have mentioned their grandmothers, you know, when we had conversations about it. I think everybody's grandmother, you know, unless she's on crack or something, has sort of the same effect in their lives. So a lot of people are kind of soft on that secondary parenting, for lack of a better word. You know what I mean?
Right.
Grandmothers just kind of, you know, by that time in their lives, they've softened up a bit, and they have the advantage of being able to send you home when they get tired.
There you go. And they always believe you're going to make it. Describe the 70s when you were about as big a musical star as anybody in pop music.
Well, I don't know if I ever was that big a star. I've probably gotten more attention since I stopped doing it than when I was doing it. When I was doing it, mostly I played small clubs, which were like my favorite. But I think that the fact that some of this subject matter translates between generations. I mean, grandmothers ain't ever going out of style. You
That's
know
right.
what I mean?
And there's nothing but classic in this tune right here.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away.
You know, that's such a very sparse arrangement. It's just you and a guitar and a bass, right?
Well, that was basically me and the MGs. Remember Booker T and the MGs?
Sure.
That's me and the MGs minus Steve Cropper. Steven Stills filled in because Steve Cropper couldn't make it. That ain't a bad band to get started with, huh?
You could do far. You know, worse than that. But, you know, the thing about that song for me, Bill Withers, is that song is so nakedly emotional. Like, it's just completely and totally heartfelt. And that's not an easy thing to musically express something that seems personal to me when I hear you singing it.
Did it make you see something?
It made me feel something.
I'm kidding with you.
There ain't no sunshine when Celeste is gone from this studio, I guess.
That's because I turn off the lights.
I would think so. Celeste sounds like a very cheerful person.
So, you know, part of the story in Steel Bill is really the difficulties and the changing world for African-American musicians. Do you think the world is a better place for black musicians today?
Man, that's hopefully it's a better place for everybody. Yeah, I would say so, because the young people that have come along, people like Jay-Z and P. Diddy and all those people, they really are good business people, and they're into ownership of what they do. A long time ago, they just buy them a Cadillac and, you know, and give them some pocket change, you know.
You know, there's a moment in your film where Cornel West, the historian and African-American philosopher, really asks you what you want your legacy to be, and you don't really have an answer for him. Do you have one now?
Nah, I don't care. Legacies are for people who've died. I won't be here, so, you know, whatever somebody wants to do, have at it. I won't feel the pain, you know.
Celeste and I were talking about our favorite Bill Withers tunes, and we were saying that these songs are like friends.
Yeah, they become like part of your history, yeah.
They're almost your babies. Do you have a favorite?
No, but let me tell you an interesting thing about that. A lot of times, I'm not necessarily identified with the songs. They're just songs. I'll tell you a funny story. One Sunday morning, I decided to go to Roscoe's Chicken and Waffle and indulge my need for cholesterol and fried stuff and, you know, just do it up at Roscoe's.
Lord be praised.
And there were these ladies sitting in this booth next to me, and they were talking about this Bill Withers song. So I thought I'd have some fun, so I stuck my head over the booth, and I said, you know what, ladies? I said, I'm Bill Withers. And they said, no, you're not. You're too light-skinned to be Bill Withers. You don't even look like Bill Withers. So,
legacies are really unimportant.
So the songs kind of go on their own, which is fine with me. It saves me a lot of trouble, you know?
Well, no trouble talking to you, Bill Withers. Soul legend, famous for the classics Ain't No Sunshine, Lean On Me, and Lovely Day, and, of course, the subject of the movie Steel Bill, which is being screened around the country right now. Bill Withers, have a great day.
You too, bud. And Celeste, keep smiling, sugar.
I will, thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's a lovely day in Nashville, Tennessee, where the Tea Party Convention is moving into day two. You like that transition
Did he just say Just keep smiling, sugar.
I was passing Bill over Withers that part. I was actually not calling attention to the whole sugar incident. But we were asking our listeners about the platform for their new political party, hopefully not the sugar party. Let us know if you were creating your own party, what would name of it be and what would the platform be? 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also go to our website to hear the full interview with Ron Paul.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway. Just one look at you. And I know it's going to be.
A lovely... To investors, it's all Greek. A spending party in Greece caused markets across the world to sell off yesterday. The Greeks want to keep borrowing, and Wall Street is getting scared. The Dow lost more than 250 points yesterday.
The markets are betting against them, saying they can't keep doing it.
Now, can a glimmer of positive news on the U.S. jobless rate turn things around today? The unemployment rate drops from 10% to 9.7%. In globalism's dizzy dance, workers have to read Greek and step lively on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, February 5th, and The Takeaway is trying to gauge reaction to that unexpected jobless number, 9.7% from 10%.
That's a good sign, right? We had lots of experts who said it would happen in February, and look at... They were right. Well, let's get right to the top stories this morning. The unemployment rate, as you said, it dropped to 9.7%, even with 20,000 jobs being lost. The Labor Department says that's because a survey of households found the number of employed Americans rose by 500,000. The job losses are calculated separately. All told, the department says the Great Recession has eliminated 8.5 million jobs. That's the most of any recession since World War II. President Obama's priority is turning that around. As part of his focus on job creation, he's expected to press Congress to temporarily expand two lending programs for owners of small businesses. The plan's expected to be announced today. It would temporarily increase the cap on Small Business Administration Express loans from the current maximum of $350,000 to $1 million.
All part of the details investors are going to be taking a look at today. We're rejoined by Michael Hunter, markets reporter with the Financial Times. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, John.
So is there any reaction so far to this unexpected unemployment number?
Yeah, we're off session lows in London, and Wall Street futures have picked up. You were saying earlier the Dow lost 250 points yesterday. It's still going to fall, we think. It's going to lose only about 7 points. There were much larger declines forecast earlier. And you're absolutely right. The overall unemployment rates come in below forecast levels, meaning more people are in jobs, and that's cheered sentiment on markets around the world.
Well, they've got the whole day to chew it over and to find some clarity in all this. Michael Hunter, thanks so much for following this. We're going to talk more about the economy in just a moment. An apology but no recall from Toyota's president this morning.
Please believe me, we always customer first is first priority.
Akio Toyota also said Toyota would soon announce what steps it will take to address brake problems in its 2010 Prius model. They did not announce another recall, though. Toyota is investigating possible brake problems with its Lexus hybrid as well. The company says it hasn't received any complaints about the car, but it's looking into it because the Lexus uses the same brake system as the Prius. The NATO offensive in Afghanistan is underway this morning. British troops are now carrying out helicopter advances in the Helmand province. They're preparing the battlefield for what will be one of the largest assaults in the 8-year-old war. General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, says one reason he announced the offensive in advance was to give insurgents a chance to lay down their arms.
We're trying to signal to the Afghan people that we are expanding security where they live. We are trying also to signal to the insurgents, the Taliban primarily in this area, and the narco-traffickers, that it's about to change.
U.S. commanders say the offensive will be backed by a larger Afghan contingent than ever before. Looking at the markets, futures are now flat after positive unemployment numbers. The Dow will start at 10,002. The S&P starts at 1,063. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,125. We're going to talk to two people who've written a photojournalism book that compares the relationship between Haitians and Cubans in Miami.
Some fascinating and beautiful pictures there. And the Tea Party Convention moves into day 2 down in Nashville. We're asking our listeners to tell us the platforms of their own political parties.
The party that I would go for is, number one, the Truth Party. The platform is to tell the truth about what's really going on, not spin, and then make your decisions based on that.
Thank you, Doris from Flint, Michigan. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the economic numbers.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning this morning. Good morning, everyone. You might say it's a double dose, a dose of political sensitivity and economic volatility. Numbers out of the Labor Department this morning, unexpected and very, very interesting. The unemployment rate dropped in January to 9.7% from 10%. That's even with 20,000 jobs being lost out of a total sample set of about 130 million. The Labor Department says it's because a survey of households found the number of employed Americans rose by 500,000. The job losses are calculated separately. All told, this complicated statistic shows that the Great Recession has eliminated 8.5 million jobs. That's the most of any recession since World War II. But 9.7% is a positive number. And joining us to talk about it is Floyd Norris. He's the chief financial correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Floyd. And also with us is Elizabeth Williamson, who's the White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
So, Elizabeth, first of all, let's try to take this complicated number apart. The job losses are different from the job gains, and so the percentage number is a sort of something of a composite. Explain how that's calculated.
That's a tricky one. Well, basically, this is based on a survey of households, which is why you see a revision in the number, quite a substantial one, by the way. There are now 9.3 million Americans out of work as of December, and that's a big revision based on a look back to 2008 by the Labor Department. So those numbers, I mean, focusing on the numbers of Americans that are out there looking for work, focusing on the underemployment in addition to the actual jobless rate is the correct way to look at these figures.
But it also makes it hard for, say, Barack Obama to come out today and take credit for a lot of positive news when those numbers, as you say, don't necessarily translate into a lot of good feelings on the part of voters, correct?
You're absolutely right, John. What business hates is uncertainty, and what these numbers actually do is add to that uncertainty. So they really do give and take away.
All right. So, Floyd Norris, we saw yesterday the effect of uncertainty about debt issuing in Europe caused all kind of volatility on the market. So what do you think the reaction is likely to be today?
Well, the markets around the world were selling off this morning, and they seem to have bounced back a little bit, at least the U.S. futures on the jobs news, which generally I think looks pretty good. One interesting fact in it is that their survey says the number of people with manufacturing jobs went up last month, and that's the first time that's happened since January of 2007.
Yeah, it was something like 11,000 jobs, factory jobs,
right?
It was
11,000 jobs. Yeah. These are, you know, these numbers are subject to considerable error, and you shouldn't jump all over them. But they do show what we've known from a lot of other studies. The manufacturing sector is coming back, not only here but around the world. And there is a decent recovery going on, it appears, even though people are very glum about it.
Which is an argument, Elizabeth Williamson, for the Obama administration to stay on the jobs message and to stay on the we are growing manufacturing, we are creating jobs here, even if that's not necessarily an absolute truth out of these figures, correct?
No, that's absolutely true. And I think you will see them really capitalize on the manufacturing numbers and say that this is proof that the stimulus and some of the other efforts they're attempting to make, although those have, you know, arguably not yet taken full route, are starting to move numbers in the right direction. Manufacturing is enormous for this administration, and the fact that you would see some growth in manufacturing jobs is very important for their message.
So if the Obama administration tries to use that as their message today, Floyd Norris, what would be wrong with that, looking at the numbers the way you see them as a financial correspondent?
Well, I think the one of the great problems is administrations seek to take credit for good news and to escape blame for bad news, and there's a little truth in both. It's they managed last year, not only this administration, but to a significant extent the prior administration and a lot of other governments around the world, to rescue us from a very severe credit crisis and panic, and things are looking good now. Another thing in the unemployment numbers that I think is worth noting is that for the first time in a while, we're seeing a decline in the number of people who say they're unemployed because they lost their job. And we're seeing an increase in the number of people who are unemployed because they've decided to enter the labor force.
Well, that's interesting. So these are voluntary career changes.
Well, the people reentering the labor force are presumably people who were discouraged, or at least many of them are. Obviously, you may be reentering the labor force for other reasons. Your child is now old enough, you feel comfortable going back to work or whatever. But we've been seeing an awful lot of unemployed who had simply gotten fired. And we still have a lot who got that, but that number seems to be turning down.
That's interesting. That's so what's really important for the administration, forget today's photo op, Elizabeth Williamson, is to really predict where the unemployment number is going to be in 2012 when they're going to be running again, and certainly much later this year when the off-year election is taking place. Any sign in these numbers that that prediction is going to make any sense?
Well, that's a really tricky endeavor, as we've already discussed, and as you see from the constant revisions that come out when the figures are released each month. But they did make an attempt to do this when they released the budget on Monday, and it was a negative picture. I mean, the unemployment rate going into Mr. Obama's reelection campaign still doesn't look very good. I mean, they had said when they signed in February, just about a year ago, the Recovery Act, that they thought it would reduce the jobless rate to about 8%. That hasn't happened. And now they don't predict, there's now diminishing expectations. They don't predict that the jobless rate will fall below 8% at any time before he runs for reelection.
Finally, Floyd Norris, will the markets today be looking for a confidence-building number out of these unemployment figures in the sense that so many investors believe that American consumers are kind of the cash ATM in the global economy?
I think people are interested in what American consumers will do, but I think this is providing a little bit of good news at a time when the nervousness out of Europe was providing bad news, and that should stop the decline in the markets today, or at least certainly minimize it.
All right. Well, it certainly turned the futures around, which were really negative this morning and now are mostly flat. So even though there may be an end-of-day loss on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it looks like a flat opening. Floyd Norris, chief financial correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and Elizabeth Williamson, White House reporter for the Wall Street Journal, reacting to the 9.7 unemployment rate for the month of January. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's go back to the headlines. Celeste?
In economic news, the Labor Department, as you said, says the unemployment rate fell slightly last month to 9.7%. That's down from 10% in December. Moving on to Toyota. In his first press conference since the global recalls began, Toyota President Akio Toyoda apologized to customers and said he's doing his best to get vehicles fixed.
I'm trying to do this work as soon as possible and with cooperation of our employee and our supplier, and the dealers.
Toyota is considering a recall on 270,000 Prius hybrid cars over brake problems. The automaker's also taking a closer look at their Lexus hybrid to see if it has the same problem. We're going to get more on this story in just a few minutes.
Those 10 American missionaries who've been charged now with kidnapping children in Haiti are facing up to 3 months in detention as they simply wait for a trial. Their defense attorney, Edwin Koch, blames the group leader, Laura Silsby. He says she was told several times she would be arrested if she took the 33 children out of the country, but he says he'll do his best for the other nine. In Iraq, a car bomb explosion on the outskirts of the southern holy city of Karbala has killed at least 27 Shiite pilgrims. And back in the U.S., there are winter storm warnings for the Mid-Atlantic, including states from Virginia to New Jersey. The storm could bring 1 or 2 feet of snow to some area. Bruce Terry, a meteorologist from the National Weather Service, predicts the storm will be dangerous.
That's a look.
In addition to 1 to 2 feet of snow accumulation on the ground, it will become very windy later Friday night and Saturday. So in a lot of places, there's going to be near blizzard conditions or maybe blizzard conditions.
That's the storm expected to move out by tomorrow. That's some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, who had a good week and who had a bad week?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for some news takeouts on stories you're following this week. And the big story this week, of course, is Toyota. We got an apology, another apology, from Toyota's president this morning.
Please believe me, we always... customer first is first priority.
Akio Toyota also said Toyota will soon announce what steps it will take to address brake problems in its 2010 Prius model. They did not announce another recall, though. Toyota is also investigating possible brake problems with the Lexus hybrid. They haven't received any complaints about the car, they say, but they're looking into it because Lexus uses the same brake system as the Prius. Joining us now is Hiroko Tabuchi. She's the New York Times business reporter in Japan, and she was at the Toyota's president's press conference this morning. Good morning.
Hi, Celeste.
Do we know why they're delaying calling for another recall on those 270,000 Prius models that could have possible brake problems?
Right, yes, that was a surprise to us. We had expected Mr. Toyota to announce a Prius recall, especially because of all the criticism and it was receiving in the States and of all the reports of brake malfunctions. But Mr. Toyota told us that Toyota was still looking into a lot of the reports it was receiving and that it had not yet found cause to recall. Issue a recall. It's not quite clear why Toyota is taking so long, especially because it has also received criticism for being very slow to issue some of the recalls. For example, with the sticking pedals and also with the floor mats. And so, again, Toyota appeared to be dragging its feet, and I don't think that was a very good move on Toyota's part.
Well,
and
as
it was, big surprise for us.
As you say, a lot of the criticism now is coming over the fact that Toyota has been secretive when problems have occurred, that they've fixed them, but haven't actually issued recalls when they know that some models out on the road had problems that they later had to fix. Have they made any comment about that?
Well, both Mr. Toyota and Toyota's head of quality, Mr. Sasaki, both said that Toyota had not was cooperating fully with U.S. Federal authorities and that it had not withheld information.
Do they make any comment about their reputation as a brand that stands for quality and safety? Did they make any comments about that?
Well, Mr. Toyota did tell us that he believed that quality was Toyota's lifeline and that he would put regaining public trust in the company even before profits.
And
so,
they also,
he did.
I was just going to say they've also said that they're going to be looking into possible problems with the Lexus hybrid as well. Do we get any sense that there could be more announcements of further investigations on other models?
Well, the Lexus hybrid, together with a new model of hybrid, the Sai, which went on sale in Japan, they both use the same brake systems as the newest Prius, the 2010 model. And that's why Toyota is also looking into those models for possible brake problems. However, they told us today that they had yet to find any reports on brake problems in those two models.
Okay, Hiroko Tabuchi is the New York Times business reporter in Japan, speaking about Toyota's president who apologized this morning. It was the first time he'd apologized over the global recall, probably not the last. Thank you so much.
So it's Friday, and in cooperation with our good friends at The Week magazine, we look back to see who had a good week and who didn't. This is our Good Week, Bad Week segment. First up, we learned that, this fuzzy critter who we hear about every February 2nd, right? You know who I'm talking about, Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog. He made his 124th prediction on Tuesday, forecasting six more weeks of winter. You know, but we learned that he actually has all good weeks. Listen, first of all, here's Michael Johnson, an official with the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club.
This year, he did see his shadow. He was frightened back into his burrow and is anticipating 6 additional weeks of cold weather.
All right, so bad news for the rest of us,
bad,
right?
Yeah.
But no, the reason it's a really good week for Punxsutawney Phil is because he wasn't frightened by the folks at PETA, who insisted that Phil the Groundhog should be replaced by Phil the Robot.
To quote our president, Phil is treated better than the average child in the state of Pennsylvania. He has 2 regularly scheduled visits to a veterinarian each year. He lives in a climate-controlled, state-licensed and inspected habitat called the Groundhog Zoo, which is right in the center of Punxsutawney. He leads a very coddled life and certainly flourishes in that lifestyle.
Certainly very coddled. What does that say about the state of Pennsylvania, though? I mean, I'm kind of worried about that. Now, Sunday, a lot of Grammy winners had a good week, but winning 4 Grammys can seem less impressive when you sing out of key at the award show.
She wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts, she's cheer captain, and I'm on the bleachers.
Yeah, Taylor Swift kind of fell flat there.
It wasn't just Taylor Swift that fell. She also dropped one of her Grammys as she was walking backstage. Yeah, and she broke it. So not a good week, actually a bad week for Taylor Swift.
If you've got nominations for who had a bad week or a good week in the news, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@takeaway.org. Listener Abdul Mozip wrote us to nominate Toyota for bad week and Detroit auto companies like Ford and GM for good week, not bad. Send us your nominations at the takeaway at mytake@takeaway.org.
We're also coming up in just a moment. We're going to be talking about the Baptist group from Idaho are facing charges now of kidnapping after attempting to take 33 Haitian children over the border into the Dominican Republic.
Idaho, there's an independent sort of place, right?
People, they're the cowboy spirit.
Would start their own third parties in a place like Idaho, right?
Speaking of
there you go. The Tea Party down in Nashville. In honor of it, we want you to nominate your own party.
The party I would want to have is one that is for the rich, for the owners of this country who made it great. I want to prohibit any poor people from participating. I want corporations to rule the country. I want none of these illegal immigrants to come in. Oh, but I do want a strong military to push our will onto other countries. It's the GOP, isn't it?
That sounds sarcastic.
Ooh, man.
Something tells
our
me
listeners.
He's being facetious.
877-8-MY-TAKE. MyTakeAtTheTakeAway.org. A party of one.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a closer look at that group of Baptists from Idaho who are now facing charges, serious charges of kidnapping and conspiracy over their attempt to take 33 Haitian children over the border from Haiti into the Dominican Republic. We'll talk about that in a moment. First, let's take a look at the news headlines at 30 minutes after the hour. The unemployment rate in January dropped unexpectedly to 9.7%. Earlier, we spoke to Newsweek columnist Dan Gross, who told us among the highlights from the Labor Department last hour is that there are more manufacturing jobs now.
Companies are adding people. Car companies, you know, production in this quarter is much larger than it was a year ago. So there are kind of incremental gains in manufacturing.
But the news was not all good. All told, 8.5 million jobs have been lost in this recession, the most of any since World War II.
And the markets are reacting this morning after futures were down for Wall Street all morning long. They turned around after that unemployment number came out. The Dow is now open up about 7 points, the S&P up about 2 points, and the NASDAQ up about 8 points. NASDAQ doing the best this morning. Toyota's president officially apologized for the recall problems that have plagued the company in the last few weeks. It also did not announce a recall for problems with brakes on the 2010 Prius. One of the largest offensives in the Afghan war has begun this morning. British attack helicopters clearing the outskirts of the city of Marja in Helmand province in preparation for a larger NATO assault. And here at home, the New York Attorney General's office filed civil charges against Bank of America and its former CEO, Ken Lewis, yesterday. Says the bank misled investors about Merrill Lynch before it acquired that company early last year. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We have new news out of Haiti this morning. 10 members of an Idaho-based Baptist group have been charged with kidnapping and criminal conspiracy in Haiti after they tried to take 33 children over the border into the Dominican Republic. We're now familiar with the details. They claim the children were orphans. They say they just wanted to help them, but the Haitian government isn't buying that. In fact, they've charged them, as I said, with kidnapping. There's a possibility that they'll serve 15 years in prison if they're convicted, and there is no chance of posting bail. We've also heard that the group's defense attorney, Edwin Koch, apparently blames the group's leader, Laura Silsby, and says she's the only one that should be charged, and she knew she was breaking the law when she started taking the children and attempting to bring them over the border. Joining us now from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, is New York Times reporter Mark Lacey. He's been covering the story, and he was at the courthouse yesterday. Mark, you weren't allowed inside, but you spoke with the prosecutor after the charges were filed, correct?
Yes, I spoke to the prosecutor actually on the way in before the hearing, and I spoke to the attorney for the accused. And this is a case that the missionaries thought was going to end yesterday, but it's going to go on. It could go, could stretch into months, and these detainees, if they're eventually convicted, could spend many years in Haitian jails.
As you said, you spoke with the group's defense attorney, and he blames the group's leader, Laura Silsby. He says she knew that she was breaking the law, but that the other members of the Baptist group that were with her had no idea that they were doing something illegal. Did you get any sense from the prosecutor that the Haitian government is singling out Laura Silsby?
Well, at this point, what the attorney for the 10 actually said is that 9 of them were completely unaware of what was going on, and they were being led by one, Laura Silsby. He still believes all 10 should get off, that they were not intending to traffic these children, but they weren't knowingly violating the law, he believes. However, he said only one of the 10 can conceivably be charged. His argument, though, didn't fly. The prosecutor charged all 10 of them. And the charges, as you mentioned, were child abduction and conspiracy, but the trafficking charge was dropped for all 10, and that was the most serious charge.
Because they had no evidence that they planned to actually take these children elsewhere. Other than the Dominican Republic.
Exactly. The trafficking charge was the most difficult to prove. The prosecutor didn't really explain why he dropped it, but that was the toughest one to prove. The missionaries were bringing children across the border into the Dominican Republic without proper authorization. That's clear, and that one he believes he can prove.
Okay, Mark Lacey is the Caribbean correspondent with the New York Times. He joined us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. We're also joined by Mark Johnson, a longtime Idaho resident and president of the Gallatin Public Affairs in Boise. He spent 9 years as chief of staff to Idaho's former governor, Cecil Andrus. Good morning, Mark. Help us understand this Baptist church from Idaho that wanted to go help children in Haiti. Help us understand the community out of which this group came.
First thing you have to understand is it's a very churched area. This is a highly religious state, maybe one of the more religious places in the country in terms of people's attendance, regular attendance at church.
You know, the not having lived in Idaho, but just knowing it from the people that I know there, there's this kind of idea of Idaho as this very libertarian, very independent, strong-minded state. And to that extent, this story kind of makes sense, that these are people who saw a problem in Haiti and said, well, we're going to go over there and we're going to fix it.
It's probably a myth in a lot of ways, but there is a notion about the West, and Idaho subscribes to this in the main, that you're a place of rugged individuals. They take action based upon seeing a problem and trying to solve it. So I think the local reaction in the main has been, we're waiting to figure out exactly what happened and what the motivations were, but there's been no rush to condemn. Probably a sense developing that these folks were to give them the, you know, the benefit of the doubt, well-intentioned but probably awfully naive about the way they were going about approaching this, not very sophisticated.
Tell me a little bit about this church and its place within the religious communities. It's a large, very high-profile church with a lot of standing?
I would say no. In fact, I only vaguely aware of it. My personal religion is Catholic, which would be kind of the second most dominant religious affiliation in Idaho.
Mormon being the
largest.
LDS
community would be very, very strong in this part of Idaho. And then a whole range of, from sort of the evangelical, conservative, right, religious right, if you will, to a more mainstream Protestant denominations, the Methodists and that sort of thing. So, but lots of church going, lots of people that are very, very engaged in a sense that, you know, we're trying to help here.
I mean, it sounds like you're describing a community that's kind of waiting to see, that's not rushing to condemn and is having the sort of stay out of everyone else's business attitude. Does that hold clear for pretty much everything in Idaho?
Well, you mentioned the libertarian streak that runs through the state. I think there is a sense that, you know, mind your own business. I won't get in your way if you don't get in mine. And that's a strain that is long dominant.
Or if
you're
talking about Ruby Ridge, it goes a little beyond that even.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think is going on here, and probably fairly far down the list of concerns in Idaho, but we've had some, as you suggest, John, some image problems in the past that have been driven the narrative that Idaho is a place where crackpots come to reside. An unfair image in my estimation, but nonetheless, I think you're probably seeing a little bit of that reaction at home.
That's Mark Johnson, the president of Gallatin Public Affairs in Boise, former Idaho journalist. He spent 9 years as chief of staff to Idaho's former governor, Cecil Andrus. He's reacting to the news out of Haiti that 10 members of an Idaho-based Baptist group have been charged with kidnapping and criminal conspiracy as they attempted to take 33 kids out of Haiti and into the Dominican Republic. So we're asking you about political parties in the U.S. today. The Tea Party Convention is in its second day, and we're asking you, if you were going to create a political party of your own, what would the platform be and what would you call it? On our website, Charlie writes, the party would be called the Big Middle. It would strive to mobilize all moderates while marginalizing the extreme right and left. What's your take? What would you call your party and what would you fight for if you could make up your own? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Bobby, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Bobby Marshall, president of online ticket selling. Everyticket.com, can you get me tickets for the big game?
I absolutely can. How many would you like, 10, 20, 30?
30? You know, it's a smaller group. Let's say 6. How much is that going to set me back?
Done. If you want to sit premium seats, lower level, probably looking at about $4,000 a ticket, so roughly right around $24,000 to get you into the game.
Now, Bob Marshall, president of Everyticket.com, I would have thought that's a low number. My feeling was, you know, maybe they'd be 10,000. Is the price going to maybe go up between now and actually Sunday?
It could. It kind of bounces around a little bit between that number. I think yesterday was around 3,700. It could probably go up to right around 4,500, somewhere in that ballpark is what we're projecting.
So I'm talking to you. You are in Miami at this point, right?
That's correct.
Now, economic indicators, we look at a lot of them on this program, can we look at the Super Bowl tickets and the market for Super Bowl tickets? And, of course, this is the highest rated, you know, television event possibly in the world. Have they fluctuated this year?
John, they have. It's gone down from the last time the Super Bowl was in Miami. That same ticket I just quoted you at, which is, that's a bargain, was about $8,500, and the Super Bowl was played here in 2007. So for the same type of seat, so you're looking at half the price, basically.
And does that make things bad for you, or does it just mean more people can go and actually get involved?
Well, what actually is happening is less people are going. That's what's bringing the price down, and it's not great for obviously the opportunity is there for people to still come down today, tomorrow, and go to the game for much cheaper than what they've been able to in years past. As far as bad for us, it's probably better when the price was higher, so there's more margins to work with, sure.
So where do you get your tickets? I mean, do you actually buy them, or do people buy them and then put them on your site and get a piece of the action themselves?
We do carry quite an extensive inventory, but also we do sell other people's tickets as well. So we would get them probably from fans that decided, hey, I can make some money on this ticket. The face value on most of the tickets is anywhere $800 to $1,000. 800 being for a lower for upper level seat, and 1,000 for an upper lower. Excuse me. And you know, they usually mark them up, and we see what we can do with them.
All right, if I wanted to sit in the cheapest seat in the stadium, what would that be?
You'd be looking at an upper level. We'd maybe throw in a pair of binoculars, but it'd be about $1,350.
$1,350 still.
Still, exactly yeah. Correct. But again, in years past, last time the Super Bowl was played here, that ticket was about $3,000.
Now, you know, we're in partnership with ProPublica, who's a website that actually takes a look at Capitol Hill, and we're trying to figure out how maybe congressmen and senators would be going to the game. You know, I'm calling you to try to get tickets. How do lawmakers and big shots actually end up getting tickets usually?
An assistant calls.
Well, that's for sure. But is there a big business in, like, donated tickets or passing them around to VIPs?
What do you mean? Donated tickets, like...
Well, I mean, I want you to come to the game. I need to give you a gift. Are tickets gifted a lot?
Sometimes, yes. That's true, yes. We actually have gift certificates, and people do call up and say, hey, I want to take, you know, such and such. This person's been an important part of my, you know, whether it's an anniversary gift or for someone as a gift or at work or something. Not much work-related lately.
Finally, can you give me the breakdown, New Orleans fans versus Indianapolis fans? Who's winning?
I would say for sure a lot more New Orleans fans,
all
definitely.
Right. Bob Marshall, president of EveryTicket.com, selling premium tickets to sold-out events. He's got tickets for the Super Bowl. Get them now.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. What do you get when you combine 19 years of work with 28 gorgeous photographs, 16 amazing writers, and 7 photojournalists all making one project? Well, what you get is a book called Havana and Haiti, which gives us a really nuanced and complex portrait of the relationship between Haitians and Cubans in Miami. We're going to talk about that in a moment. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. This morning, Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, apologized to customers during his first press conference since the company began its massive recalls. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke with New York Times reporter Hiroko Tabuchi in Japan. She elaborated on the message from this morning's conference.
Well, Mr. Toyota did tell us that he believed that quality was Toyota's lifeline and that he would put regaining public trust in the company even before profit.
The company's president also admitted the 2010 Prius has brake problems. He did not announce a recall, though. He's only saying the company is considering one. And in economic news, the Labor Department says the unemployment rate fell slightly last month to 9.7% from 10% in December.
And the markets are reacting accordingly, opening flat, not repeating yesterday's huge, huge sell-off. In Washington, GOP Senator Scott Brown of Massachusetts was sworn in yesterday, a week earlier than planned. And the big story this weekend, the Mid-Atlantic bracing for a serious winter storm, 2 feet of snow, expected in some areas from Virginia to New Jersey. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
This week, we welcome Miami and all of South Florida to the Takeaway family with WLRN down there. And we've been talking to some very prominent thinkers and writers from the region, prize-winning writers like Dave Barry and Leonard Pitts and also Edwige Dantica. Two of those writers, Pitts and Dantica, contributed to a collection of essays and photographs that not just caught our eye, it catches the eye. The collection is called Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. It was produced by our guests, Carl Just and Luis Rios. They're co-founders of the Miami-based Iris Photo Collective. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Luis, let's talk about some of the photos in here. There was one pair of photos that really struck me, and it's the only black and white set of photos in there. I'm looking at it now. On one side of the page, you have a black and white photo of two prostitutes in Havana. They're standing in the middle of the street. One is adjusting her hair, it looks like, and the other one's talking really animated with her purse slung over her back. On the other side, juxtaposed, is a photo out of Haiti with two little girls, possibly sisters, I guess, wide-eyed, looking at the camera, very beautiful little girls. One's clasping the other's hands to her breast, and they're dressed in these lovely lace little dresses. I guess they're going to communion. I mean, the picture of innocence juxtaposed with the photo of these prostitutes out of Havana. And I'm wondering how you chose these photos, what you were trying to say about these two communities.
What we have here are really two independent looks, I think, at in a very artistic way, the harshness of living, you know, in a place like Haiti and a place like Cuba. That you can almost switch the two photographs. What's happening is there is a first communion day for the two young girls in Haiti. The other one are two young girls in the early morning hours, you know, after what we call the day's work. And when I first decided to put these together, this is the only pair of photographs that we compare and contrast. They're actually run in black and white. And for the sheer purpose of you know, looking strictly at context, you really have innocence in both photographs. And that was the intent of that. And to run them in black and white was really a way to point out the starkness and show the sort of the similarities between these two cultures.
There's another pair of photographs. In fact, let me contrast a couple of them, because there's a pair of photographs in which you show one Haitian detainee and one Cuban detainee, both of them in Guantanamo Bay. And those are sad photographs. They're not especially happy. But at the same time, you have photos of this incredibly colorful, looks like a sunrise, and a stone angel coming out of Havana. And out of Haiti, you've got this beautiful blue skyline over the ocean in Haiti, and the side of a boat that said, "God love me." It's like you have this message here of how complicated this is, these communities where life is so very difficult, and yet the people are so resilient and clinging on to hope.
And that's the point that we make, you know, with the entire set of photographs. Pretty much what we have learned about Haiti sort of in a backward way, and Cuba, more specifically Havana, is that both of these peoples throw themselves into the ocean to come to South Florida, Miami specifically, for either political reasons or economic reasons. In both cases, in both of those countries, we know about the economic upheaval, you know, and the complete desolation of Haiti. You look at Havana and the unending wait for the fall of a dictator for the last 50 years that appears that it will never come. And what we do with the angel in Cuba, in Havana, is to offer hope. And that is the sort of the way that the Cubans, especially the expatriates that live in South Florida, the United States, look to. The people there, this is a constant struggle for them. With Haiti, it's the very same thing. Both have strong Roman Catholicism backgrounds, and that is ingrained into their culture. I think when they look to the United States to come to, that's the only way of freedom that they expect. You know, I mean, there's a very famous line in a song that says, that talks about freedom, which means there's nothing left to lose. And for both of these peoples, there is nothing left to lose to obtain that freedom that they both so dearly, you know, want.
That's photojournalist Luis Rios. He's half of the team that produced this new book, Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. The other is photojournalist Carl Joost. He's with the Miami Herald and co-founder of the Iris Photo Collective. Carl, did you go, when you were taking these photos, did you go knowing what kind of photos you wanted to take?
No, actually, these photos span 19 years, and they were never meant to be paired together. It's during the course of having an exhibit during our Basel in Miami, Luis and I kind of put our heads together and we started looking at images from both countries and saw, wow, this is dynamic bridge, this is dynamic visual narrative that connects the two. And personally, my mother lived in Cuba and is of Cuban descent, and I'm, of course, was born in Haiti. So it is this dualism that keeps repeating in my life. So it was just a natural fit.
You know, in there you have a picture of Havana with the rainbow over it, which we were listening to Luis talk about. And there's another one that's a picture of Port-au-Prince before the earthquake, which is just a beautiful photograph. And there, it seems to be a comment upon the struggling and the suffering these two communities have gone through and how that has transformed them, maybe in parallel ways.
Yeah, I think both of them have a sense of home. And both of them are departing their home because they seek a better future. that rainbow that casts over Havana. Yes, it's beautiful, but you look at the buildings, they seem to be dated and deteriorating. Again, like Mr. Rios, as Luis had said, hope, faith, freedom are themes that keep echoing throughout this project. It was very important. Both Luis and I really respect the written word, and we also respect the visual narrative. But we wanted to have both narratives take equal space in the book. So we went through a lot of pain and design to make sure that one complements the other.
19 years of work represented in this project with 28 really, really beautiful images that you can actually see on our website, thetakeaway.org. That's Carl Juste, a photojournalist at the Miami Herald, and Luis Rios, a photojournalist and editor of the Iris Photo Collective's latest book, Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. Really, I encourage you to take a look at the pictures at thetakeaway.org.
Well, and the one community we're welcoming this week into the Takeaway family is South Florida, joining us on WLRN, and those images and all of the coverage of South Florida that we've had this week is available on our website. And we've also been covering the Tea Party. Their convention moves into day two. We've been asking all of you to tell us the platforms of your new political party.
Hi, my party is going to be to vote the bums out, and it's kind of self-explanatory.
Hey, Troy calling from North Dakota. My new political party platform would advocate maintaining enough of our armed forces just for homeland defense only, and redesign the remaining forces and equipment to form the ultimate disaster response machine.
Hi, this is Susanna King in Aiken, South Carolina. My party platform would simply be do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Thanks, Susanna. You can join the party. Form your own at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Edley.
Have a good weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.